You are listening to Secret Handshake, the podcast covering the movies that help you identify your friends and maybe make a few more along the way. Coming up, Spine number 73, Dan O'Bannon's Return of the Living Dead, featuring punks, puke, graveyard strip shows, queasy morticians, shady military men, atomic explosions, suburban grave robbers, rebel teens, Mexican street gangs, the River Man, and brains. Martin.
Yes.
You think this is a fucking costume? This is a way of life. Welcome back to another edition of Secret Handshake. I'm your host, Jacob Knight, and joining me as always is Martin Carlson. Martin, so this is the last edition of 2024 Secret Yes. Handshake. How do you feel?
Good, good.
I feel bad.
Oh, as the, you know, the world's on fire.
Yeah, that it's not great.
But movies have never been better.
Yeah, we're going to have, I guess, to give you a little bit of a preview coming up. Pretty soon, one of our first episodes in 2025 is going to be our yearly wrap-up of the best of 2024. But before that, we're going to do Return of the Living Dead, the movie that I would argue is the second best zombie movie of all time behind George Romero's Dawn of the Dead. Do you agree or disagree?
I would agree. I think it also is, we talked about this with the Candyman movies, that you have, you know, the films that kind of got it all started, and you have the person who kind of codified it in a way that a lot of audience members and people who talk about zombies today are actually referencing this movie as much as they're referencing Romero films. Like, the whole brains thing is this film.
Yeah, 100%.
And O'Bannon, the creator of this, way ahead of his time in that he saw the comedic, I don't think it's the first full comedic zombie film, but he's the guy really created. Like, you wouldn't have Zombieland today. You wouldn't have Warm Bodies today. He saw, I think, the comedy inside of the zombie subgenre and kind of went all the way with it.
Well, and also, like, you kind of wouldn't have this movie if it weren't for the, I guess, staleness of the zombie film already by like the mid 80s, because yeah, all you really have are the George Romero riffs happening.
And some stuff in Italy.
And some stuff in Italy, which are basically knockoffs of the George Romero films, like with Lucio Fulci's Zombie, which was, you know, titled Zombie 2 in Italy. But O'Bannon had this vision for zombies that was both, it was kind of fit perfectly into what he wanted to do overall as a filmmaker, was that they were funny and they dealt with a kind of working class subculture that he'd already explored with Alien by basically having, you know, the crew of the Nostromo be this kind of like working class blue collar, like bunch of, you know, put upon workers who encounter a aberration beyond the stars.
Yeah.
We'll say here you have punks fighting zombies, and punks being like basically the lowest of the low, even in like a musical subculture, and going out and hanging out in graveyards looking for a place to party, and they just happen to find themselves in the middle of a chemical outbreak that raises the dead and honestly spawns maybe the first horde of fast zombies we've ever seen, because like these zombies, they don't shamble the way that Romero's zombies did in, you know, Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead. Or even Day of the Dead at this point, too. Although I guess Day of the Dead would come after this movie.
Maybe the same year.
Right around the same time. But, like, in this one, like, the dead rise, and they are, to quote the soundtrack, which might actually be the great, at the very least, the greatest horror soundtrack of all time.
Yeah.
They're ready to party, man. And, like, they get down, and they want to just bite into your head and eat your fucking brain so that they can keep going.
Well, what's also, I think he has so much fun with the rules of zombies is that these things are unkillable.
Right.
You can't, like, chewing the head doesn't stop them. You can dismember them, but the whole, I think what's great about this film is it has a very, trying to watch it with new eyes. I've seen this, we've both seen this movie a bunch of times. This I put as a really fun, I've seen it so many times, I know every word. I put it on the background, I make some food, the music's great. But I really sat down and I tried to, like, watch with new eyes this time of, like the first time. And what's interesting is O'Bannon, I actually have his screenwriting book I got for Christmas a couple years ago. And as we'll talk about more when we get into, like, Jason Zinnemann's shock value and the history of Dan O'Bannon, is that he was a prickly guy, very cocky guy. And
I think prickly is putting it mildly. Yeah. He seems like a gigantic asshole.
Yeah, and he lost a lot of very successful friends, Ridley Scott and John Carpenter among them. But what's interesting in his book is, like, you get into the beginning, and he's very cocky about, don't follow a very strict structure unless you want to make a film that's been made 100 times before.
Yeah.
Which I totally get.
Which so is very punk rock unto itself.
Right. And you watch this film, and it does have a very, like, oh, wow, like, I didn't see, if you try to watch it again, like, the first time, I didn't see that coming. I love that you have, because the punks are all riding around waiting for Freddy to get off work. And for me, the highlight of this film are Tom Matthews and James Caron, their duo, and they're so funny together, especially early on when they're learning about, they're just, again, the very Dan O'Bannon working class guys talking about, oh, you got it, this is a 2-1-C and filling out forms and things like that, and make sure to put enough packing peanuts when we ship the skeleton away. And
it's literally Freddy, Tom Matthews' character, first day on the job. Yeah. He's more or less getting trained.
Yeah, and he's learning how to work at this.
You need a medical company.
Yeah, and they're shipping like skeletons and, like, half dogs to medical schools or science classrooms and things like that.
You know where they get all those perfect skeletons, right?
India. They got skeleton farms.
Is James Caron, like, is this the funniest performance ever given in a horror movie?
Well, real quick, yes. And I think what makes it also funny is the surprising quality of what keeps happening is they're like, cool, we got this thing, we can't kill it. Oh, next door is the crematorium. Let's bring it over there. Oh, shit, now it's creating a fucking acid rain that's pouring down the trioxin into the ground to wake up all the zombies. It's kind of like every normal step in a horror film of, like, we know how to beat it, keeps going wrong. Up until the very end, they launch a nuclear bomb, it creates another rainstorm, which is going to have it all happen all over again. So it has this comedic, like,
possibly globally at that point.
Globally, yes, exactly. But I think James Caron is, he and Tom Matthews together are my favorite parts of this movie.
Their back and forth doesn't feel scripted. That's the thing that I love most about it. Outside of, like, the whole intro where he's walking everybody through and, you know, he starts talking about, you ever see that movie Night of the Living Dead? And he talks about how, like, because it's based on the idea of, like, John Russo, the original author of Night of the Living Dead and the co-writer with George Romero back on the 68 Night of the Living Dead. You know, part of the genesis of this movie is that he always felt kind of wronged, is that they took his creation away from him. George Romero gets basically all the credit, and he goes on to be a semi-successful pulp novelist and filmmaker in his own right. Like, he would make shit like The Majorettes, which is, you know, and these very low budget, like, slasher movies. And he was very much like a splatterpunk type author. He wrote very low pulp and kept churning stuff out. And, like, Return of the Living Dead feels more in the vein of, like, his type of writing and, like, a reclamation of, like, hey, like, all this stuff that was happening over here, it almost, like, disavows the George Romero movies while also being kind of a direct sequel to them at the same time.
Well, calling it Return of the Living Dead.
Exactly.
You know, you,
there's a middle finger quality to it that I've always loved.
Well, in a pre-internet audience probably thought this was a real sequel.
Exactly.
You know, they didn't know going in, right?
And then you go and watch it and you realize that, like, this might also be maybe the first true splatterpunk movie, like in the most genuine or literal sense of the term, is that it's about a bunch of punks who, and correct me if I'm wrong, O'Bannon actually wanted to cast non-actors in the punk roles so that he had a kind of sense of chaos, the same way that, like, you know, Alex Cox was doing with, like, Repo Man.
Yeah.
But the studio was like, no, you're not going to do that, because, you know, O'Bannon had never directed a movie before. He was an untested filmmaker. He was already known for kind of being a loose cannon creatively. There was some friction over Alien, even when he made that movie, and Ridley Scott took that over because he originally was going to direct that as, like, a low-budget kind of creature feature called Star Beast. Had contracted H.R. Giger, like, basically sent him, like, the script and outline, like, very crude concept art, and, like, according to Zinnemann's shock value, like, $1,000 check for Giger to come on and do the Xenomorph creations. Like, one of the big pieces of lore about Dan O'Bannon, and, like, one of the big controversies, is that you'll have these very small factions of, like, film fans who try to claim that Alien is more of a Dan O'Bannon vision than it is a Ridley Scott vision, because he was the one who brings Giger into the fold. He's the one who writes the original screenplay with Ronald Chushit, and that Ridley Scott basically came on to a movie that was more or less prepped for him and just shot the shit out of it. I'm not one of those people who subscribes to that, because I think, like, that kind of misconstrues how the filmmaking process actually works, frankly. But there was, like, a solid amount of Dan O'Bannon vision that went into Alien before it actually got shot.
The chest-bursting thing in particular, everyone agrees, was his thing.
Because,
like, that was his idea.
Because, again, according to the book, it's like a representation of his battle with Crohn's disease.
Exactly. His discomfort.
He always was battling with stomach pains and digestive issues, and that's where, like, the original idea for the chest burster came from, was from this chronic illness that he dealt with on a regular basis. But, like, Alien's still a Ridley Scott movie. Like, if you watch Alien...
And some Walter Hill, too.
Well, Walter Hill.
With Ridley Wright's, yeah.
But, like, you watch it, and, like, visually, it's Ridley.
Yeah.
Like, you can draw a clear line between, like, Alien to Blade Runner to Legend, to even, like, Black Rain.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm sorry, Dan O'Bannon couldn't have made those movies the way that Ridley made them. And you watch Return of the Living Dead, and you can see that kind of clearly, but the thing that Return of the Living Dead does have is where there's an almost stoic and painterly aspect to Ridley's visualization of Alien. Like, Return of the Living Dead, like, it's a real punk, madcap spontaneity. Again, like, between, like, James Caron and Tom Matthews' characters, and even, like, the punk collective that comes to meet up with Freddy and party in the graveyard, like, a lot of their dialogue, for as writerly as Dan O'Bannon was known for being, like, it feels like of the moment. Like, he almost, like, captured these little snippets of, like, back and forth that, like, these guys were coming up with on the spot.
Well, he also, I mean, like, he gets performances out of people like Linnea Quigley, who is not a very good actress, but she, as Trash, is amazing, because
her scream queen extraordinaire.
But her flat affect, I've never seen someone use it better. When they're pulling by the cemetery, she goes, "Oh yeah, let's do that." Or her whole thing where she says, "You ever thought about being killed?" And he knew how to use
about dying.
But you think about her in this versus how, and this film pairs so perfectly with
Night of the Demons.
Yeah. I mean, they're almost the same movie.
100%.
And
she's amazing in both.
And she's great in both, but I think she works better in this one, in Return of the Living Dead, because Trash is a much more memorable character.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and her character in Night of the Demons, like, that's the picture I had her sign when I met her. And But trash is, there's something, Bannon as a filmmaker, there is a throwing a lot at the wall and seeing what sticks, and as a writer too. And so from reading the Zinnemann book, which, first of all, shout out to that book. It's one of my favorite film history books. It's
we've quoted it so many times on this podcast.
Yeah, and in previous times too. But rereading these chapters was so much fun. And like, even like, I couldn't, that book literally sucks me in every time. Next to like Easy Riders, Raging Bulls by Biskin, it's probably the best film history book I've ever read. I mean, like, it just sucks me in. But you have O'Bannon is an idea man. Like, that guy was ideas, 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 ideas. And they talk about him, he always needed a kind of cool-headed partner. That's who Carpenter was for so long. Is when they met at USC, Carpenter was this calm, confident guy.
Easygoing,
and knew how to, like, he had to be cool, and people liked him, likable. And O'Bannon was always this, like, almost kind of sickly, angry, opinionated, and they even said, like, when they became friends, everyone's like, you guys are working together? Like, to John Carpenter.
It was a real odd couple situation when Dark Star happened.
Yeah, and Dark Star, I think I finished it one time. I was trying to watch it for this, and they're like, I can't believe it didn't take off. It is a fucking slog, but that film is all O'Bannon. That feels like O'Bannon at...
Yeah, uncut.
Uncut, because he's also, as that book explains, he's a production designer. Like, that's why he got brought onto Dune. He was going to work on Dune. That's how Alien happened as well with 20th Century, is he was really good at taking a penny and turning it into $100 and making a ship look, like, the background look really good. And he worked on Star Wars.
Yeah.
You know, some of the stuff on the Millennium Falcon, I believe, and some of the background blinky lights is him with, you know, basically, and you know, getting a lot of money for not, getting a lot of value for not a lot of money. But I think his also is he doesn't know how to edit. Like, a lot of his stuff just feels like, and then we talked about with the Screamers episode with robots, that feels like O'Bannon. That's an O'Bannon story where it's meandering, people talking. It can also go very bad very quickly. And this film feels like a happy accident to me at the same time. Like you're saying, it's improvisational, but there's a reason I don't think he made a lot of films.
Well, yeah, and by all accounts, like, there's some great documentaries about the making of Return of the Living Dead, one of which was on the Shout Factory release. And it sounds like it was a very chaotic set. Like, Clu Gulager, like, didn't love being there and clashed with O'Bannon, might have even thrown a chair at him at one point.
That tracks.
Yeah, you know, like...
Like, has been around the industry for forever, since he's a kid.
Exactly. Yeah. He comes from, like, a real old-school, like, studio background, and here's this fucking wild man trying to make this punk rock zombie movie, and it just wasn't working for him. But, like... The magic that's captured with Return of the Living Dead is incredible. And there's also this distrust of authority that's woven into all of his screenplays in particular.
Yeah.
With, like, Alien, you always have the company who's looking to screw the working man out of their next dollar and their bonuses. In this, you have the military men who are always kind of at the fringes looking for the tetrotrioxin barrels that are in the basement of the UNITA medical facility, unbeknownst to them, you know, and it's really, they only discover it because the entire movie is almost predicated upon accidents. Like, James Caron tells him this story, you know, hey kid, you ever hear about this movie, Night of the Living Dead? He's like, the barrels, they're in the basement.
You want to see them?
See them?
The corpses.
And he takes them down there and, you know, he's fucking around. And he goes, oh, this is fine. U.S. military grade. It'll hold up to anything. Bangs it with one hit, and then all of a sudden the tetratrioxide just starts basically, like, you know, emitting into the air and starts the chaos. And then, you know, it does become, to your point, like a series of, like, calamities, you know, to where it's like, oh, the only way we can get rid of this corpse that's been reanimated is take it to Ernie, the mortician next door. He'll burn it in the cremator, and then that creates the acid rain. Then the acid rain creates, you know, the next wave of zombies. Meanwhile, you know, the duo from UNITA are turned into living zombies themselves, and they're, like, quickly decaying before our eyes, and like rigor mortis is setting in into like Freddy's back and shit. Like, that's so gross when the blood starts pooling in his back and everything. And then, in order to essentially try and contain everything, they call the military by accident. You know, like, these military characters are introduced in the first, like, couple minutes of the movie and don't really come back. It's almost like bookends to the entire thing, in that they're only notified because they're, like, at one point, you know, Cool Gulager is basically like, well, maybe we should call the number that's on the barrel. And they do, and that's what ends up being the nuclear bomb that destroys the entire town at the end. In like, the most apocalyptic finale to like a movie that otherwise, that's the other thing about this movie that I've always like loved ever since I was even a kid and seen it for the first time, like the balancing of tones is so bizarre, is that it goes from being absolutely hilarious in one scene to like straight up terrifying in another,
yeah,
to like the end of this movie was something I still to this day, even as like a 42-year-old guy, and we revisited it, like, I was like, I still can't believe that you're allowed to do this in a movie that, like, you're just like, oh, the military finds out and they just nuke one of their own American towns. Like, that might be the most punk rock thing about it.
Well, that's what I think connected him to Carpenter for so long, is they both were these really anti-authoritarian guys.
Yeah.
You know, personality-wise, very different, but you have the apocalypse, you know, trilogy we talk about with Carpenter as well, of the, and also in Hall's films, a huge distrust of authority, and also these apocalyptic endings of, like, the world's basically fucking over. But I think O'Bannon, another thing that, you know, this is a film that I think a lot of people maybe unknowingly reference when they think of zombies, you know, especially when you think of just, like, ooh, like, full-on brains, almost the funny, cartoony zombie, is that I think O'Bannon was one of the first ones to really get into the military created these things.
Yeah.
And so I don't think you get Resident Evil even, for real, without this movie. I think that he was ahead of the curve on that as well. You don't, you know, you get, obviously, Planet Terror is pulling, is very the zombie you'd find with gas and things like that. It feels very referential to this film.
Well, and also, like, it gives you two different types of zombies, right? Is that you have the fast-moving zombies that come out of the graveyard when the acid rain starts, but you also have the tar man who's in yep. the basement. And that feels almost like, again, kind of like a middle finger to the Romero zombies from Night of the Living Dead in particular, is that it's almost like, these are your grandpa zombies. They're in the basement. They're rotting away. They're slimy. They're gross. You can evade them pretty easily. And at a certain point, you can even knock their fucking head off with a baseball bat, you know? Like, these don't pose the greatest threat. What's the greatest threat is outside. It's the yeah. horde of fast-moving punk rock zombies who are going to take us all down, and you can't even escape from, even if you have a car in the end.
Yeah, there's no escape.
And, like, the other thing that's incredible about this movie is just, again, simply the soundtrack. Like, it felt like it, Repo Man is the other movie that I keep coming back to in comparison, is that it just felt like O'Bannon had his finger on the pulse of a particular type of musical scene, and, like, having bands like The Cramps come in and play, you know, The Surfing Dead for the soundtrack, is that it's just an incredible mix of a very specific time period and punk rock in punk rock itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember this, like, this was, I think they released it on record, very much like the Fright
Night.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, this is the era of Fright Night, too, where these horror films had these, like, really good, like, Fright Night had Jay Giles Band, like, these kind of big, interesting.
Texas Chainsaw 2 has Oingo Boingo.
Yeah, just some really cool, you know, cool stuff. And then, obviously, Night of the Demons had a lot of, I guess Night of the Demons just feels so, they saw this, Kevin Tenney saw this.
Oh,
was,
yeah.
And was like,
I want to do my version of
but
that.
But with just demons.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're basically zombies, so.
Do you remember seeing this for the first time?
Yes.
Okay.
I actually saw it late. So, I mean, by late, I mean junior year of college.
Oh, wow.
So.
I saw it like 14 or 15.
Yeah, it was just one that I had not seen. So, actually, I watched this. And I watched this in a double feature with Night of the Demons for the first time.
Okay.
And so I was a junior, and then my good friend Derek, Derek Baxter from film school, his roommate Evan was a big horror guy, also a big Linnea Quigley guy, and was like,
how could you not be?
I know. He's like, you haven't seen these movies? And we sat in there. They lived in our dorm. He goes, we watched them back to back. He also showed me Assault and Priest 13 for the first time.
Ooh.
Another just
late. Good friend.
Yeah. And I was just like, holy shit. But like, I remember seeing it and being like, this shit's really, really funny. I actually saw part two first. It was like on cable.
I'm surprised you watched part one.
Well, yeah. When did you see? So 14?
Yeah, it was on TNT. Joe Bob Briggs' Monster Vision.
Yeah, it tracks.
Was the first time that I ever saw Return of the Living Dead. And because I remember I went and rented the VHS afterwards so I could see the uncut version. But even playing on TNT, the big thing I remember being the edit was that when you have the naked half zombie that they bring in and talk to, because that was the other mind-blowing thing. Because I'd seen Night of the Living Dead, I'd seen Dawn of the Dead on VHS at this point, and the idea of zombies talking,
yeah,
was kind of mind-blowing, and that they bring the one with the red hair who's like rotted and cut in half, and they interrogate her being like, why do you eat brains? The pain! And they like find out like why they're actually after what they're after and everything, and that scene's incredible. But on TNT, it was blurred out like a porno because you see her boobs,
yeah,
and everything. So there's that like blurry kind of like smudged where it almost looks like Vaseline is on the lens over her nipples and stuff. But like outside of that, like the brain eating was pretty much intact. Like all the violence was there.
They cut trash out completely, her dance.
Well, that was also blurred.
Okay,
that was the thing, is that it was back in the TV edit days where like you would get, you know, some choice edits put in for like basically all of Suicide's dialogue.
Yeah.
You know, and like they would blip stuff out. But like, you know, for Trash's dance, like it's again, she gets up on the tombstone and you see the whole thing, but all of a sudden these like weird little blurs are on her nipples and are on her pussy too. And then, you know, when I went out and read, I think Trash's dance was what made me go down to the West Coast Video and actually get the VHS tape of this, is because I was like, well, I want to see that girl fully naked. And then I did, and I wore that tape out. Let's just say.
Well, Linnea was just like that.
She's so hot.
Well, and she had such a corner of that market, of like that level of horror film. You know,
yeah.
Like, and I rewatched.
And she had no qualms getting completely naked.
Well, she'd done some softcore stuff. Like, she had, yeah, been in Hollywood, and she's, you know, I just rewatched.
She ended up doing the workout take. Too.
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny because I feel like she and Barbara Crampton ran in different circles, but Barbara has gone obviously to a much different,
right,
career, and also had more, was a better actress. You know, is a better actress.
I think there also might have been some substance stuff with Linnea too.
It seems like she was just in town for. It was actually funny. It was her and Tarman. The guy who played Tarman were both at the Horror for the Holidays thing, run by Blood Over Texas,
okay,
which was a great event. That's where I got that Cenobite print. But she was there and very sweet woman, but I think, you know, I don't want to talk out of class, but it seems like she's had some troubles.
You get the impression that along with the softcore and kind of like dabbling in a lot of that B movie arena, you know, she indulged in the pleasures that went along with,
yeah,
it.
Yeah, exactly.
Now Return of the Living Dead 2.
Woo.
It's weird because, like, the thought that I had revisiting this one was that this is like if Evil Dead 2 sucked. Like, because it's a weird, like, soft remake.
Yeah, you got Tom Matthews back.
And James Karen.
Basically playing a similar duo.
But they're grave robbers this, yep, time, and they don't have half the charisma or chemistry that they did in the first movie.
And they're trying the same jokes. They're just having them moan, but it doesn't work.
Yeah, and James Caan's doing like the total manic, oh, I'm falling apart thing, but it just doesn't work like it did. Because that was the thing, is O'Bannon had a sense of comedic timing,
yep,
and jokes and stuff too. And like, because also if you've seen his other movies that he's written, like Dead and Buried. Dead and Buried is fucking funny.
And awesome.
We'll it's get to that so in a second, good. But, man, that one of the best like Gary Sherman films. And then also like Life Force has a great sense of humor about it too. And like he just, even Alien, going back to that whole, again, like working class banter that you have between like Yaphet Kotto and Harry Dean Stanton. Like he had a knack for dialogue that just didn't feel scripted.
Yeah.
It felt like guys like bouncing off of one another. And with Return of the Living Dead 2, I mean, it's also like a great example of what happens when you get a lesser director to come in. Like you have Ken Wiederhorn, who, you know, we knew him from like King Frat and
Meatballs 2.
Meatballs 2 was like his main thing. And like that's, he didn't really have much more of a career after this.
What an interesting thing to think about is we did the Meatballs series, and you have Meatball 1 lives and dies. Meatballs 1 lives and dies on Ivan Reitman and the charm of Bill Murray and the rest of the cast, right? And then this is very similar, where it's like, what makes Return of the Living Dead as much, you know, as difficult as Dan O'Bannon was, to your point, was had amazing comedic timing, was a dialogue master, honestly. He could write dialogue in his sleep. Sometimes it would go on too long, you need to be edited, but here's another guy coming in, also because Ken Wiederhorn wrote the script for part two.
Yeah.
He wrote and directed it, so it's almost like a case study, and like, cool, what if it's the exact same idea made by a less talented filmmaker, or just by a different filmmaker, and you see how good Dan O'Bannon really was.
Because that's the other crazy thing, too, is that Robert Elswit shot Return of the Living Dead 2.
It looks good.
Who would go on to direct, you know, or shoot movies for, like, Paul Thomas Anderson and shit.
Yeah, it looks beautiful.
So, like, it looks great. It's just weird because he also takes all of the character and texture out of it, because instead of being in a graveyard hanging out with a bunch of punks and morticians and weird working class dudes, you're just in the suburbs with this annoying kid and these grave robbers.
Well, and then you have the, what's his name? Dana Andrews?
Ashbrook.
Dana Ashbrook from Twin Peaks. And then, so we have, you have the milquetoast, handsome cable guy, the ditzy sister, the annoying son, and then Tom Matthews and James Caron doing kind of a version they did in the first movie. And they pick up the doctor in a similar thing to having Ernie next door, but it is just a slog and it's repetitive. It just go from one place to the other to the other. It's just brutal.
Well, and it feels like a movie made by a guy who was used to making comedies.
Yeah.
And that's what the studio leaned on too much. It was like, oh, okay, well, Return of the Living Dead was funny. So that's what the people want. They want their zombies to be funny again. And it's like, not really. Like, it was a whole mixture of stuff that...
Yeah.
And really, Return of the Living Dead was, like, true alchemy. Because, I mean, there's a reason beyond his prickly nature that, like, Dan O'Bannon didn't really direct a movie again until The Resurrected, which was in, like, 1991, I want to say. Is that, like, he just struck gold with his one try behind the camera and then never really went back.
Yeah. Well, it's just, and I don't even know it wasn't that big of a hit when it first came out, right?
No.
It's been completely reclaimed, and it's a horror fans, it's up there with Evil Dead 2 in terms of fandom. People love this movie.
And if you watch this movie with, like, I've seen it on 35mm 3 or 4 times with a sold out crowd, and every time, like, that, it just hits. Like, it's fun. It's funny, it's gory, it's violent. It's
sexy.
It's super quotable, it's sexy. The soundtrack fucking rips, especially if you get a great print that's going through those theatrical speakers. Like, it's hard to beat as an actual, like, cinematic experience in an auditorium.
Well, that's what's so weird, you know, to also, just thinking about the idea of sequels, is I think the film was meant to be one movie. Like, there's no sense of, like, Dan O'Bannon ever had an idea
of
this being a sequel. It's all kind of a joke of, like, it's playing, having fun with zombies, Romero zombies. It's doing his own thing, but then being like, that's it. So even doing a sequel is, like, folly to me. Because it's like, that kind of loses the point,
Yeah, 100%.
Why they did it in the first place.
Yeah, you don't understand why you even try, because it's just like, we made an unofficial sequel as the first film.
Yeah.
Like, it's a total middle finger film. Like, franchising it out loses, like, you're automatically going to lose the impact of what made the original special.
Well, it's exactly what happened with the weird Day of the Dead. They had Day of the Dead 2 and 3, those weird, you know, all because of the rights things.
Well, and also, that's a great way to kind of segue into, you know, Return of the Living Dead 3, is that from here on out, they become DTV movies.
Yeah.
And, but Return of the Living Dead 3, a lot of fun, because it's Brian Yuzna doing a total Brian Yuzna thing, and it really is like, not connected to the first two at all. It's almost like just in name only, and that he makes more or less like a rebel without a cause, kind of teens on the run thing that feels closer to like a James Dean movie that just, you know, happens to involve zombies and tetrachioxin, and then a kind of tragic Romeo and Juliet love story at the center. But then it goes completely fucking haywire and links up to the other kind of DTV movies that Yuzna was making at the time, with like one of the ones we just saw at the Exhumed Films Marathon this year with Necronomicon.
Yeah.
Is that they're like special effects splatter showcases.
Well, yeah, and I didn't see this till a couple years ago, but I remember seeing this amazing, this has got to be one of the best VHS covers of all time.
Oh, yeah.
Is she's on the front and she's, you know, got all these piercings, but then like just pieces of glass sticking out of her. And I remember just like, it was one of those things when I was young, being scared even by the VHS cover.
And she's so hot.
Yeah. And finally seeing it, it's actually lives like you, she's, that's what she looks like most of the movie.
Well, like, and it makes a whole running gag out of her piercing herself to almost like retain feeling as a human while she's like turning into a zombie.
Yeah. Which like keeping herself alive in a kind of way. And I, again, to, we were talking earlier about how, like, I think Dan O'Bannon kind of was one of the first to do, the military created these things. Like, they Yuzna really goes in on the secret government, almost like stand-esque facility of, we're running tests on how to turn these zombies into soldiers, to modern soldiers. And they have all different ideas about, but the first thing is, how do we stop them? How do we like turn them off? And they have this whole amazing freeze gun. It shoots a freezing bolt into their head. And this whole sequence, it's just heaven for me. Like, I love.
It's so gross.
It's so fun. And then you have, again, this Romeo and Juliet thing of this, the son of the general who kind of runs this, or the captain who runs this facility. He's like this punk kind of motorcycle kid.
Which is crazy, because he almost feels like Bobby from Twin Peaks, but Dana Ashbrook is in Return of the Living Dead 2.
Yeah.
He should have played this role.
Yeah, and this guy plays the young Butterfield in Lord of the Illusions.
Oh shit, you're right.
But I love the kind of the setup of like, he immediately tells his dad, I don't want to, like, because his dad has to move. They're going to move towns. He goes, I'm not leaving her behind. I'm leaving. And they go on a motorcycle trip. Immediately they crash. She gets ejected off the motorcycle straight into a fucking telephone pole. And he goes, oh, I just saw people resurrecting bodies back at my dad's military base. Let's do that. I'll do that. And, like, this movie also, I think, does, though, capture the randomness. I don't think it was intentional. The randomness of the Dan O'Bannon script for the original. And then, ooh, that's a weird twist. And then meeting Riverman.
Well, here's the thing that it feels like to me is like, it comes from the Yuzna playbook of his, it almost feels like him piecing together a bunch of movies, because, you know, like Necronomicon is an anthology film. Yeah. That's both him and like Christoph Gans and stuff, and like
the Japanese filmmaker. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, it feels like a bunch of short movies that they piece together and then put, you know, the whole like Jeffrey Combs kind of wraparound story with it so that you have a feature film. This feels almost like he was kind of like, okay, well, we can make a Return of the Living Dead movie. We have this like star-crossed lovers, like James Dean thing going on. But, and we get to a certain point, but like, ah, shit, I've kind of run out of story. What if they run into like
some gang members,
these cholo gang bangers in like a 7-Eleven who are playing video games and are mad because they're trying to get the high score and she's like interrupting them. And then it becomes a run all night where they're like chasing them. And then they go into the underworld with Riverman, with Riverman is such a strange fucking character.
I love him. I love him.
Because he's a homeless veteran.
He's a homeless veteran who is a little, he's supposed to be obviously crazy, and but he's this comic book type character.
Yeah.
You know, and he has this whole thing about almost like pay it forward.
Yeah.
He's got this whole thing. It's actually kind of a nice moment. It's out of the blue where he says, you know, they're like, was like, why are you helping us? He's like, well, old man gave me this Mardi Gras coin. He helped me years ago, so I'm going to give it to you. And you help somebody.
Yeah.
You know.
But it feels like that was a leftover from like another script that he might have had laying around. It was like, well, what about this Riverman character? What if they ran into him? He took them into the underworld and it became like a full-blown, like, psychotically. Because at this point, it almost becomes like Necronomicon because he takes them into almost like another movie where it becomes this like completely total psychotic splatterpunk visual effects showcase where like Riverman like gets his head like ripped off to his spine.
No, it's not Riverman. It's
is that not Riverman?
It's the main bad gang member.
Okay.
And it looks like one of the characters from Beyond. I mean, again, full on.
Yeah. And it looks like it. Well, because that was the thing that I remember even talking to you off mic about is that like we love the Stuart Gordon movies and we've been talking about doing a Stuart Gordon episode for like the longest time. But watching a bunch of these Usna movies inadvertently in a row, you know, between Necronomicon and this and like a couple others, is that you wonder how much, like, Gordon was obviously like the director who was able to ground Reanimator and From Beyond and Dagon to a certain degree and make them not feel as chaotic as the Usna directed films, but like, Usna has a very distinct psychedelic splatter visual kind of palette that totally bled into not as much Reanimator, but definitely From Beyond feels as much like a Usna movie as it does a Stuart Gordon movie.
No, I think it's totally fair. They were a great duo, you know.
Yeah.
And we were talking about Dan O'Bannon and Carpenter having someone who's like the wild man.
Yeah.
You know, the wild idea man, the one guy who's kind of like the grounding artist. And no, I mean, I totally agree. This film is really,
Gordon coming from like the Chicago theater scene and stuff and being able to bring this troupe of actors along with him. And he introduces him to Jeffrey Combs and everything. And then Jeffrey Combs ends up playing H.P. Lovecraft in the wraparound story in the Necronomicon. But like, yeah, it just feels like Usna's the Dan O'Bannon in this situation where he's just throwing as much insanity at the wall as he can.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think what, you know, this is a film though, that I think I highly recommend for just like Gorefest fans because like it delivers.
The last 30 minutes of this are insane.
It's absolutely insane. Well, even early on, there's an effect that I think is one of my favorites. There's this earlier test subject that's kind of like chasing the young lovers through this military facility. And it's this like melty looking dude with this huge flap of skin, like leading from the top of his head down to his shoulder.
That's gross.
And they shoot him and he sits down and he moves his head and like the skull peels away from all this flesh and it drops away. And it's just one of my favorite, honestly, like up there favorite horror effects. And I know everyone worked on this, like Steve Johnson, who also obviously worked on a lot of shit, including Night of the Demons.
Right.
But this is a fucking effects like reel. Of a movie, as are a lot of Usna's films.
Very sticky.
Yeah, it's real gooey.
I remember seeing this movie for the first time. There was a weird period where, you know, all this quote-unquote new technology was coming out, particularly with computers.
Yeah.
Where computers were starting to have DVD players in them and everything, DVD-ROMs.
Yeah, I remember that.
And certain studios started putting out almost like DVD-ROM movies that were broken up into like 50 chapters.
I remember that.
Jason Goes to Hell was one of the ones that I had. And Return of the Living Dead 3 was another one that I had. And I remember watching this movie on a computer, and it's like 360p resolution.
Yeah.
Yeah, at best, probably like 280. And it's broken up into like 60 chapters, and like each chapter was only like 2 or 3 minutes long. And like sometimes there would be like this weird thing where it would like hit the next chapter and there would be like this weird almost like hesitant like delay before you got to the next one. You'd be like okay, and then you go, the story would keep going. And I remember watching Return of the Living Dead 3 that way in a dorm room in eighth grade when I was at boarding school.
Wow.
Exactly.
That's, dude, it's like Electronics Boutique shit.
They
had a whole wall, I remember. I was like, well, they also made movies just for computer. There were some CGI-y early, basically just cutscene.
Right.
Weird stuff. And it was all like 40-minute movies, but that's a weird... be weird to find those in
weird era.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't even know if you could play those anymore.
I don't know. They're probably on YouTube. I'm sure some weird person has uploaded them.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. But it's like the people who collect like laser discs or like, what are those like giant, they almost look like floppy discs, but they have like a giant almost like CD inside of them. Oh. And you used to put them in those old like front load players. It's like all this old technology that's like, these companies were coming out with in the wake of the VCR and stuff. We were like, well, what's the next wave of like home video? And
yeah.
It's like, will people want to watch these on discs? Will they want to watch them on their computer? And it's like, no, we don't really want to do any of that shit.
No, we want it to look good.
Yeah.
And sound good.
And let me tell you, it didn't. But I watched it on that Dell computer as best as I could.
But what was also fun about this episode is you and I both were like, felt the need to watch more O'Bannon films. And he worked on some good shit. Like Dead and Buried, I hadn't seen this in years, is gotta be one of my favorite 80s horror films.
Yeah. I mean, Gary Sherman, one of my favorite kind of undervalued directors, made Deathline, also known as Raw Meat, made Dead and Buried, Vice Squad, my second favorite cop movie of all time. Actually, probably my favorite cop movie of all time, if we're being real. I mean, he's just...
Poltergeist 3, which is solid.
Sure.
It is.
I mean, it's not in the same... We're talking about great movies, though.
You're right.
It's not in the same league. What are we doing here?
Yeah.
But, like, Dead and Buried, incredible film, but continues... I guess this is a good jumping off point to talk about one of the other things that fascinates O'Bannon, is that he's a Lovecraft guy.
Yeah.
Like... You know, Star Beast, his original script from Alien, is very much almost explicitly stating, hey, the alien that they encounter, the monster from beyond the stars, is like an abomination unknown to man, not unlike the old gods that comes down and destroys
them. They're older, they're older than time.
It's an unknowable evil.
Yeah.
And so, like, and that continues through, you know, to Dead and Buried, where Dead and Buried has that New England foggy, like, nasty kind of feel to where it, you know, you're in this small seaside town where something nefarious is definitely going on. And in a strange way, it feels like his answer, and especially given how, you know, Shock Value kind of illustrates how he and Carpenter's relationship ended, where he always kind of, it sounds like, felt like sort of taken advantage of by Carpenter at the end, or that Carpenter was at least at the very mercenary, and that they made something together and then he moved on and became successful and was like, I'm good.
He dropped him like a bad habit.
Exactly. Yeah. And this feels like his answer to the fog.
Yeah. We were texting about how there's kind of this back and forth with them, you know, and I always feel like Return of the Living Dead feels like it pairs well, strangely, with Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah.
You know, there's this, like, they're kind of going more, it's definitely a bigger, broader, fun horror comedy. This feels like, this definitely feels closest to The Fog. And I love this movie. Like, also has Dan O'Bannon's sense of humor, based on a paperback novel. And it feels like a dingy paperback you find at a yard sale.
Yeah.
That you've never heard of before.
That ends up becoming your next best book.
Yeah.
Your next favorite book.
And it's just a really schlocky, high concept idea of what if there's a town where people don't die?
Another zombie movie,
and it's take on the zombie film. And you have the guy who played Grandpa in fucking Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory is one of the best.
Jack Albertson,
I think. Right? Yeah, great horror villain. He's in this
Dobbs,
movie.
The Mortician.
It's so good. It also pairs strangely well. It feels like Village of the Damned.
Yeah,
the same kind of thing. Another film, or even Messiah of Evil, I think pairs well with it. Of just like a strange small town beset by some kind of supernatural. Also feels very Stephen King in its own right.
Oh yeah, very much like a lost Stephen King book. Some great Stan Winston gore effects.
Oh yeah,
the needle in the eye sequence is great. The guy getting burned alive is awesome.
It's genuinely scary. You have a young Lisa Blount who ends up being in Prince of Darkness, which I don't think might have been an accident.
Yeah,
and you have this amazing opening scene of it, and the whole thing shot through this like soft focus like filter. And it
almost looks like a porn.
Yeah, it looks like a softcore porn, but also has the feel of like just a foggy painting of like a New England painting, you know, like a lighthouse or a beachside villa. And you have this great scene of this photographer, and it really makes you feel disoriented of like, what exactly is going on here? And you have this photographer who's taking photos of things on the beach,
rocks and shit,
rocks and the and
waves,
waves. And I think birds. There's also some tackle and stuff. And some boat
chicks
stuff.
Chicks doing it.
Well, and then Lisa Blount comes down. She goes, "Oh, are you like a famous photographer? Are you a model?" And it does look like a softcore scene. And you almost, when I'm rewatching it, I forgot. I'm like, "Oh, is this his wife?" It's like one of those scenes where it's like a flirtation of like, "Oh, you must be famous." And then out of nowhere, like they put him in a fucking fisher net and they Wicker Man him. The end of Wicker Man, the first 3 minutes of this movie, they burn this guy alive, and he is screaming.
Yeah, it's bad.
And his face is all pressed against the net. It's like genuinely a disturbing horror scene.
Also, incredible ending to this movie, which I won't spoil.
Very Twilight Zone. Yeah,
it has a very Twilight Zone
kind of... Or Tales from the Crypt.
Yeah, kind of end to it. EC Comics.
EC Comics all the way. Yeah.
But this is a great one. I mean, Life Force, which he and Chusett worked on as well. We've kind of already covered in our Prince of Darkness episode. Also very Lovecraftian in its, you know, Quatermass influences. But then there's Blue Thunder.
God bless
Blue
it.
Blue Thunder, a true... This is my favorite first-time watch of 2024. Since we're wrapping it all up with this episode... This is my favorite.
Like, yeah, Maniac Cop 2 was mine.
Yeah, and I watched this twice. For those who don't know, it's a real we used to make shit in this country movie because it's a buddy cop film with Roy Scheider and Daniel Stern, where Roy Scheider is like an on the edge maverick helicopter cop in L.A. who, you know, is partnered with a young rookie in Daniel Stern, and they're put into a program where they're flying a attack helicopter called Blue Thunder that has all this crazy technology and turret guns,
surveillance,
and missiles. It's surveillance. It's fucking awesome, you know. And they're taking it out on this test program. Warren Oates is like the pissed off chief. You know, who's basically playing the same character that, you know, that the 48 hours the chief would yell at, you know, Nick Nolte entire time.
Malcolm McDowell is the bad,
the smarmy adversary.
British.
Catch you later. Like, he's so fucking awesome. And also Warren Oates, like, eternally sunglassed.
It's his last movie.
Oh, is it his last movie?
The end is committed to him if in the credits. I think it was, if not his last, one of his last.
Okay.
I think he died right after, before it came out.
Yeah, because he just seems very hungover the entire time.
He still brings it.
Oh, he's fuck. I mean, he's Warren Oates.
Yep.
Man.
And what's her name? Candy Clark from American Graffiti and from The Blob. She's wonderful
as
in this.
The girlfriend. Yeah. And this is like, there's shady government conspiracies again. There's aerial battles over L.A. There's an assassination attempt. This movie is like, it's got it all, man. And also, it has the craziest last 30 or so minutes that I've seen in a mainstream movie, maybe ever, to where like they do a 9/11. At one point where they shoot missiles into the side of a building and then kind of just keep going and don't remark upon it. And I'm like, a lot of people just died. And just during the middle of this like firefight, like this movie fucking rules. And I remember saying it to our buddy Shapiro and his partner Deb, as I was like, oh shit, I just watched Blue Thunder for the first time. And she was like, you never seen Blue Thunder before?
Well, I was there too.
It used to be on HBO like every hour on the hour. And I guess I just missed it. But like, I watched this twice for this podcast. This movie fucking rules, dude.
So for us, we grew up with it. And the TV show was on. And it was James Fiorentino from Dead and Buried.
Yeah.
Played the main character. And then his sidekick was Dana Carvey, pre-SNL.
Insane.
And it was kind of a competitor around the same time as Airwolf, another, you know, combat helicopter show.
Which Airwolf obviously won.
It did. But we had the Blue Thunder toy. My brother had the helicopter. So I grew up with it as this toy that we used with our G.I. Joes. And it was the same ratio. You could use like G.I. Joe figures in the cockpit. Badass thing. You could fold down the fucking the helicopter blades. It was really cool. And then I finally saw the movie when I was young, and I was like, and I already liked Jaws, and I was like, oh, Chief Brody in it. So in my mind, it was like the same character. And
he's more playing his character almost from like the Seven Ups or French Connection. But now he just flies a fucking helicopter.
Well, and what a leading man. I mean,
incredible.
When he owns a movie, you can't compete. So good.
Nobody had a screen presence like Roy Scheider.
It's unbeatable.
Like he's a unique one-of-one actor where like that leathery, macho visage who also could be like weirdly tender and like relatable. And like every time he's in a movie, he's one of those guys that just makes it better.
Well, there's everything that all his scenes with Candy Clark are absolutely amazing. Because they have this whole backstory of like, they've been kind of off again, on again. She has a son that he obviously cares about, kind of like he's a father figure too. And they have this way of they can't quite on the same page, but you could tell it's O'Bannon. Like the dialogue is so snappy. And there's this whole thing, you think they're broken up, and then she's looking for something to borrow, and she finds this negligee, and she's like, ooh, whose is this? And she's like, I'm going to take it. He's like, well, take it. It's yours. Basically, I got it for you. And it's this whole, like, it just, again, the O'Bannon kind of surprise nature to it. It kind of doesn't have the normal flow of that scene from a movie.
Yeah.
You know, so it keeps you, I don't know, it keeps you kind of on your toes, even in a kind of, like, rote scene. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then you have, obviously, Scheider killing it, and Candy Clark, too.
And since we're on the topic, it was just revealed that Chris Nolan is going to be making The Odyssey as like his next film. But like for the longest time, it was rumored that he was making a remake of Blue Thunder. I'm going to be real. I'd rather him remake Blue Thunder. Like, I don't give a fuck about The Odyssey. I want to watch his helicopter buddy cop movie. That sounds great.
I can't. Well, and what makes the movie so great, and what would obviously Nolan would, I think, probably attracted to by it is the practical, like you said. There are things in this movie I do not know how they shot it.
Yeah.
Like, well, just alone, like when you're a kid, you're like, oh, cool, there's helicopters. When you're older and like know a little bit about film, you're like, they flew those in downtown Los fucking Angeles. What? There's a scene where,
like, so how do you get permits for this?
I that's the thing. Like, how do you, they're flying through buildings at full speed. Like you get 3 seconds of that at the end of Die Hard, like for a big, huge movie. This movie is like 40 minutes of that, of him flying through buildings. There's a scene where one of my favorite parts is Candy Clark needs to go get, because this is a conspiracy plot, the information they need is hidden on a VHS that is at the bottom of a trash can in an old drive-in.
Which, is that the same from drive-in Heat? From Heat, right? It is.
If not, it's the same kind, because it's the exact same that from the scene. I thought the same thing.
Yeah.
But she finds it. He's watching. He's like doing overwatch.
Hovering over her.
Hovering. And then she gets chased by cops, and we think she's finally pulled over, and it cuts around. Also, John Badham made this fucking film, just so that, you know, it's amazing. The helicopter rises up. It's like fucking Aliens, right? The same kind of thing.
Dude, that scene where he just fucking murks that.
It cuts it in half.
Yeah,
that he shoots it in half.
Oh, it's so awesome, dude.
It's like, holy, like the movie keeps getting bigger.
That turret gun.
And then you get the finale, which is this fucking one-on-one helicopter battle. They have built up the whole movie, his hatred for Malcolm McDowell. They have some history in Vietnam. And
yeah,
some
all the Vietnam
some court-martial shit.
Yeah.
And they go at it, and it is like a 15-minute helicopter battle.
It's Top Gun shit.
It's
in
Top
the
Gun.
Middle of downtown L.A., but with two helicopters.
It's crazy.
And it he does some straight-up Pete Mitchell Maverick shit. He flies a helicopter upside down at one point.
Yep.
And I went, I don't even know if that's possible. And frankly, I don't fucking care, because this movie rules.
It's rewatching it, and then it ends, has the... He also believes, I'm just fucking spoiler alert, but it's like no one should have this helicopter. It's like that kind of story, right?
This, yeah.
And he parks
this doesn't belong, this could be corrupted by the wrong hand.
Yeah, and he parks it in front of a fucking train, in a train yard, gets out just in time, gets hit, it blows up.
Oh my God.
And it's a freeze frame of him walking toward the camera with a fucking flaming, like, fucking train crash behind him, and it just goes freeze frame, and then it all this digital type, like a film by John Badham, and it's the credits over that. I'm just like, and it's synth, and it's like synth music. I'm like,
also, isn't it the composer is like one of the band members from Galaxy 500,
something like that. Like it's synthy, right?
There's yeah, some it's super stuff. Crazy. It sounds almost like a Tangerine Dream score.
Exactly. Yeah,
but it's absolutely fucking incredible. Like this movie is a total face melter. I kind of wish it was the basis for this episode entirely, but you know what? We still got to cover it, and I'm so glad, because, man, I was just thrilled. And it was one of those viewings where I went, where has this been my whole life? Like, this is my new favorite movie. It's so fucking good.
What's that feeling we talked about where we always want to find that, like, diamond in the rough horror film?
Yeah.
You know, like that slasher on vinegar syndrome that, oh my God, is an 81 slasher I've never seen, and then it sucks, right? You know, and it's just ass. And then you have this experience where you're like, oh, there are actually a lot of 80s action movies. They made a lot of movies like this, and that they kind of fall through the cracks.
And this is one of the great ones.
And real quick, it pairs well. We're talking about, you know, going neck and neck with Carpenter. You have Carpenter's Black Moon Rising. He wrote.
Yeah.
But it's the same idea. It's a car instead.
Yeah.
And it's so funny that who knows if they had conversations back in the day.
And that's Linda Hamilton, right?
Linda Hamilton and Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah. Incredible movie.
Yeah. It's awesome, dude. Like, super. It's a supercar that has all these, like, it's basically Knight Rider.
It feels like Knight Rider with, like, a little bit of, like, Jeff Nichols thrown in. There's, like, a proto-Jeff Nichols kind of vibe to it.
Oh, yeah. I like that.
It's real ethereal and strange, and, like, it's a vibe movie.
Yes.
Where you get just kind of in sink into it, and you're like, all right, this rules.
Yes.
You want to do questions?
Yep.
All right. Questions about Dan O'Bannon's Return of the Living Dead. Martin, for this one, let's compile our collective top five zombie films. I mean, I think we can agree that Romero's Dawn of the Dead is one.
Yeah.
Is this two?
Yeah.
Okay. What are 3, 4, and 5?
I don't know what number, but I want to throw in Wreck.
Okay.
The French film, the French version. Sorry, the Spanish version.
Spanish, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I've got to be real. I've never seen it.
It's well, actually, I Rec 1, I put Rec and 1, there's basically one movie in my mind, Rec 1 and 2. Okay. 2 is The Aliens, it's basically more action, same filmmakers.
Is there three of them?
There's four.
Four of them?
Yeah.
Jesus. I actually saw the remake Quarantine.
Yeah, it's fine.
Like, with Jennifer Carpenter.
Yeah.
So I guess I've kind of seen it, but
yeah,
really.
But the original is just like, that was, in the mythology, because it gets into like possession stuff on top of zombie shit.
Yeah.
I love the way it mixes. And you know, we were talking earlier about like Heretic not giving you like more at the end. Like, this film gives you more. You're like, oh, it's just a zombie film. It's more than that, and it fucking rules.
Okay.
So that's definitely in there.
Does 28 Days Later, yes. Is that a zombie film?
Yeah.
Would we go with that at 3 or 4?
I would say 3.
Okay.
I would do Wreck at 4.
I was going to suggest Fulci's Zombie.
Yeah.
But that's a direct, or I guess indirect, is the way to put it, sequel to Dawn of the Dead. You know what? Fuck it. Fulci's Zombie will be 5. So we got Dawn of the Dead, Return of the Living Dead, 28 Days Later,
Wreck,
and Fulci's Zombie. That's a good list.
Yeah.
I'm into that.
And if you can throw in Train to Busan there, like it's a later, like some of the.
I don't like that movie.
I love
that
movie. I like it a lot. Yeah.
It's fine. So. Double feature.
If I could pick one, I would pick Part 3, the Yuzna film.
Okay.
And I would do it with Project Metal Beast. There were just those, I think it pairs well with those kind of military horror, like something gone wrong, 1990s, a lot straight to video, kind of schlock, fast, really fun werewolf kind of horror film. Have you seen it before?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I like that one a lot.
It's fun.
Supposedly that new Gorilla one is similar.
Werewolves
is supposedly kind of in that same vein.
I haven't watched it yet, but I've heard it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I heard it's a good time.
Our buddy Shapiro gives it a big thumbs up.
Yeah, I'm definitely in.
I'm going to go with something I mentioned earlier, is that Return of the Living Dead and Repo Man, just as your punk rock genre movie, distrust of authority, double feature. I mean, these two movies kind of speak for themselves. You want to just pack in basically 3 hours of like awesome punk music, great like UFO and Living Dead like kind of genre shenanigans, and just an amazing cast kind of front and center. I don't think you can beat it as a night at the movies.
Yeah, and last but not least, the easy one we talked about earlier, Night of the Demons, is just like the it's a 1-2 punch.
The Linnea Quigley double bang.
Absolutely.
Remake.
No, man.
You can't.
I just...
You had the two DTV movies, Rave to the Grave, and I can't remember the
name of
the
other one. And now that
there's
this new one coming out as well.
Oh, that's right.
This winter. And it's like... To me, most of these feel like a rights thing. Of just like they're able to... that's nothing profound, but they're getting the rights to these things. Like Day of the Dead 2, Contagion, or whatever, or you know, this kind of thing of Return
to
Sleep.
It's just so
they
can use the name.
Yeah, Return to Sleep. Well, I guess that was actually him, but like these defunct IPs that I wouldn't even call.
Well, even what they claimed the Matrix Resurrections was, to a certain degree, was just a way for them to, you have to make this or we're going to like lose the rights or the ability for you to do, you know, the IP that you created.
Or all the Fantastic Four movies, basically.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, this has been done to death throughout the history of cinema, is that it's like rights are such a tricky thing that they'll often just make a movie so that nobody else can make one.
Yeah, and we've talked about this a couple times before, too. Like, there are so many films and IPs that are only good because of the original creator, you know?
Yeah.
And we joked about it with... You know, Clive Barker with Candyman, Tolkien, strangely with Lord of the Rings, of like, this is funny because it's O'Bannon's baby.
Yeah.
Like, and I like 3 as his own thing, as a Yuzna thing, as him kind of riffing. But like, 1 is just this kind of perfect happy accident of the 80s and his obsession, and is one of his only films.
Yeah. Because the Resurrected, which we haven't even gone into, we were talking about his Lovecraft, is the only other movie that he directed, the only other feature. And like that's just a straight-up adaptation of the H.P. Lovecraft, is the Strange Case of Charles Dexter Ward.
Yeah.
You know, and it's pretty good. It has Chris Sarandon in it and everything. But again, like, It's nothing to write home about.
Yeah. It, and that remembering seeing that film, it felt like a little bit of a wet fart. And so it's like, this is when it doesn't go right.
Yeah.
You know, like Return of the Living Dead went right in a lot of ways. This just felt kind of, eh.
Yeah. And I mean, to be fair, The Resurrected, there's always these rumors, again, because O'Bannon's so prickly over the years, that like there was a longer cut of it and it was taken away from him by producers and edited down and it's not the movie that he wanted and blah, 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 blah. But like, if you watch it, you go, well, I don't want more of this.
Yeah.
If anything, it's 15 minutes too long.
That's enough.
And that's fine. But I mean, it's a competently made, very wet and gross H.P. Lovecraft adaptation that's like, you know, 2.5 stars. Cool. I'm glad I saw it. I'm never going to watch it again.
Yeah. Done and done.
Face Melter. Yay, nay.
For Return, just the first
yes.
one? I'd say yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's some, like, longer parts of just, like, comedy, which I think are funny, but not everyone may stay on board for. But when the gore starts going, it's a blast.
Look, when the camera does that weird shifty thing and pans out, and the one skeleton pops out of the grave.
And the music.
And 45 graves, do you want a party? Needle drops. That's like one of the all-time, if you're in the theater, you want to like jump out of your seat and start running around and like spraying beer on everybody, because it's just, it's so fucking good. The energy's so high. And like, if you see it with the right crowd, like it's kind of unbeatable. So yeah, this is a total face melter.
Hell yeah.
Well, Martin, this has been another year in the books.
Yes, sir.
2024 is done. 2025, there will be more Secret Handshake and more insanity. Like we said at the top, we're going to start with our best of 2024, but then we're already kind of brainstorming what we got next. We have a lot of, frankly, very varied topics.
The Kevin Hart. Yeah, filmography. Yeah. We're definitely doing that.
The ride along movies.
Yeah, we're going to get Jumanji.
Jumanji. There's a big Jomie Calitzera retrospective that we're thinking of, yeah, but only based around his Jumanji sequels.
We're going to do the Paul Blart.
Paul Blart Mall Cop, 100%. Click, only the bad Adam Sandler movies we're going to do.
Yeah, we're going to do Click, and we're going to do Grown Ups 1 and 2, my personal favorite.
And also the Taboo Porn series, but only the third installment, because that is, I think, the most ass-fucking.
Good times.
But you'll have to stick around for the 2025 edition of Secret Handshake to see what we got for you.
Bye.
Stay tuned.
Bye.